I am immensely frustrated with this audio. And it basically boils down to this Universal Apollo Twin DAC, which last week when I came to do this video, and it's like, okay, everything's right. I'll just turn the camera on and everything will be just the same as it always is. Couldn't get any video. And I've just gone right round and round and round and round and round trying to solve this problem of as soon as I've got video going from either this camera or even brought up a little old Logitech and plugged that in just in case there was some weird Elgato cam link thing. But as soon as I start getting audio from this mic via the Apollo Twin DAC, this is running into my old Yamaha DAC at the moment, by the Apollo Twin, it's like the video goes. And I do not know why. And I lodged a ticket with Apollo, or Universal rather, and they gave me all of these steps. And I did all of the steps. I removed all the software and reinstalled all the software and I rebooted it. And I changed device properties such that we couldn't have exclusive usage by one app. And I did other things, like turned off all the power saving stuff and just burning all the fuel now in order to make this thing just run as fast as possible. None of it worked. And then I had this really good idea because this only seems to be a problem when it plays in the browser. Like if I'm in Zoom, no problems. Camera works, microphone works. This is why I don't think it's like a USB power thing. And then I thought I'll just run OBS. That'll be simple. I've run OBS before, but I forgot that it is not simple because OBS is a desktop app. And then I could run this and this into OBS, and then I could OBS stream out to you. And then I was like, why don't I just unplug it and plug in the old one? So this is where we are. Tom, I'm going to grab a beer. I should have grabbed a beer. I'm drinking water. I tell you what, I need a beer after all that. Anyway, we are live, and I will I think what I'm going to do, I would actually like to start streaming via OBS a little bit more because it is super, super powerful. You can do some cool stuff, but I just feel like OBS is not the sort of thing that you learn under duress. It's not the sort of thing you test in production, which is what I was basically going to be doing if I had gone down that route. So I thought instead I'll just do a normal thing with the temporary thing lost for words, and I have had no beer, promise. And of course now, because I unplugged the Universal DAC, I've got no sound from the speaker, which is fine because it's me talking anyway. So I'm going to keep it a little bit shorter today because I actually don't have a whole lot of content, and then with the benefit of time and less duress, I'm sure this will be fine by next week. Okay, so jumping right into it. So sponsors first. Sponsor, I think this is probably my most frequent sponsor, is Varonis. Varonis is talking about Security SWD, brand new YouTube show from them. Watch episode one on how far Wi-Fi can travel. Varonis has been a very, very reliable sponsor for many years now. And as I've said before, when Varonis has been on there, this is one of these companies that I do know in person and I have spent time with. I think I've done talks for them in London, and I know I did once at RSA as well in San Francisco. Remember we used to go to places and do talks? Fun times. Anyway, so big thanks to Varonis as well. Stratus says, g'day, Troy. Hope you're a long way away from the floods. First of all, I appreciate the question, and a few people have asked me about this. And, of course, whenever something is either underwater or on fire in Australia, which is most of the time is something underwater or on fire, or getting blown away, people ask the question, I hope you're okay. It's kind of a little bit like saying, let's just put it back in a Europe context. You know, someone's in like northern Norway and someone in Spain people are worried someone at the bottom of Spain is going to get eaten by a polar bear. You know, like it's that kind of distance. So we're about the same size as continental Europe, fraction smaller than the US. That said, we did have quite a bit of rain here in Queensland, which is my state. Most of the rain was in the southern state in New South Wales. There was some flooding, some houses lost. Bad news. I think at least one person did lose their life because they tried to drive across a flooded road. And we have so many ads about this. It's like literally the tagline is, if it's flooded, forget it. Like, don't try and drive your car across the floodwaters, you know, because you don't know what's under there. So that was a bit sad. We got a ton of rain here, which was great timing for my new weather station, which is not mounted in the proper position yet. I'm waiting for the plumbers who have to come back and fix the roof. They had to fix it before the rain. Now they've got to fix even more stuff because a whole bunch of the roof is leaking. But it was great to have that rain gauge. So I've been in the process of actually integrating the rain gauge into Home Assistant. I'm trying to find the best way to do this. I can integrate it with Weather Underground, so I can push from Weather Link, which is the Davis software. It's a Davis weather station. I can push from there to Weather Underground, but you can only push once every 15 minutes. If you want to push once every 5 minutes, you've got to buy like a pro subscription. And then if you want to push every 1 minute, you've got to buy like a pro plus subscription. And there's something that feels very, very dirty about paying just to push from one API to another. I just don't like the idea of that. But anyway, if I did that, then there's a Weather Underground integration into Home Assistant. So I thought I'll set it up anyway, and then it's like a 15-minute cycle. And I assume that it's just every 15 minutes it pushes all the data, and it's not just like you only get the readings four times an hour. But then it seems Weather Underground, their API is offline or something of the effect. So I didn't get much further on that. But anyway, the Weather Link device, which is the one that has the wireless unit, which then communicates with the actual Davis Pro that will eventually be on the roof. It's hanging off my son's balcony at the moment. That one does have an API. So you can just hit the IP address, you can hit the API and pull back a bunch of data. But I'm just trying to figure out like what's the right way to represent that in Home Assistant, particularly when you've got things like rainfall over the last 5 minutes or over the 15 minutes or over the hour. Like how should those graphs look? So my plan was, this is very, very sneaky, I was gonna get WeatherLink to push to Weather Underground and then use the Weather Underground integration and Home Assistant, figure out the best way for everything to look because all those graphs are already built in, and then just basically copy that in order to save myself several dollars, which now that I explain it that way, it doesn't sound like such a good use of my time. Anyway, it's all good fun. All right, so, things. There are a couple of things. So, number one, data breaches. There were, because it was a day ending in Y, each day this week there were data breaches. It's just data breaches everywhere. What has ever been pwned down this week? Now, there's one in particular I'm going to talk about. There's two. Because WeLeak Info is the week before. So, last week I spoke about WeLeak Info. And that was the very, very shady version of Have I Been Pwned, which literally leaked your info. Their Stripe account got broken into via the highly sophisticated method of someone registering the domain, which had been allowed to lapse, and it had the alias which managed the Stripe account. So it just snared the domain, password reset, accessed the mailbox therein, dumped a whole bunch of people's data. Now, the other one that was interesting, same sort of vein, was Carding Mafia. So Carding Mafia was breached. That data was dumped pretty publicly. I had someone, I think I had multiple people send that to me. Now, if you're unfamiliar with the term carding, this is carding, or rather credit card theft, and often credit card reproduction into physical units. Harder these days with chip and pin, all this sort of thing, but particularly back in the days of mag stripes, you get a lot of cards taken from things like compromised FPOS terminals, and then either the PAN sort of full account number stuff you stolen and then used to make online purchases, or the full numbers and all the other technical jargon that goes into mag stripes actually printed onto new cards, and people would literally go into ATMs and withdraw money. I was listening to a very good Darknet Diaries on this just the other day, actually, about Cam the Carter. So if you're a Darknet Diaries fan, listen to Cam the Carter. It was a really good one. Anywho, so that was Carding Mafia. And you kind of feel like you really wouldn't want to be identified, you know, if you're on that service. Email addresses, IP addresses, usernames, and salted MD5 hashes. I guess at least they salted them. So instead of being completely useless, it's almost completely useless. 83% of those already have been pwned. That was a very high correlation as well. Now, the other one, this is the one that's a little bit interesting, Astoria Company, unverified breach. Now, Astoria Company, I just feel this is one of the ones where I've got to read their description and then you make up your own mind about what they do. So Astoria Company, this is astoriacompany.com. It's quite slow to load. Welcome to Astoria Company, a performance marketing company. Okay, for information on the reported cyber attack, click here. That's new. That wasn't here before it went into Have I Been Pwned. Ready to take your company to the next level? Astoria Company was formed by industry experts who helped build and develop genuine customers for trusted brands. I want to be a little bit fair with these folks because there's a lot of alleged stuff here. It's basically a marketing company, and I believe that they market to leads. They have a lot of leads available there. They do now have this page on cyber attack, but just to take a step back. So this is data that was identified via a security researcher called Vinny Troyer. He has sent some things to me in the past that he has come across. This is another one of these ones. It had a very, very large amount of data, but only, I'm air quoting for people listening, only 11 million unique email addresses. He found those being sold in January. It included personal, financial, and health data as well. And what it looks like is that Vinny's alleging here, and I want to keep using alleging because I don't think Astoria is completely on the same page as Vinny on this one, allegedly obtained via various portals where people would register information that might include financial, might include medical, and Vinny's view is that data from those pages has then flowed through into this corpus, which he's found being listed for sale, has obtained and sent over to me. In their data breach notification here, what do they say? Known actors, two potential rogue actors were involved in the intrusion. User A, there's actually some good detail in here. Oh, interesting. And user A, Eastern US IP address, subsequently traced to VPN servers located in Europe. There it goes on. Genesis of the attack. If you go to AstoriaCompany.com, if you want to read this, a little pop-up on the front page that leads through to here. Data for sale on dark web. Upon further investigation of the reports for Astoria's data being for sale on dark web or the Tor network, Astoria found a sale ad posted on a popular dark web marketplace. What is out there? Okay, next steps. I mean, like credit, they've actually got screen caps of the dark code marketplace here where the data is actually listed. Some Shiny Hunters references here as well. Shiny Hunters being a rather, what's the right word, notorious, prolific hacker who's obtained quite a bit of data in the past. But again, there, without sort of going into too much detail, Astoria does seem to have some different views to Vinny on some of this, which is why it went in as unverified, why it went in as alleged. I actually did reach out to a bunch of people in this breach that were Have I Been Pwned subscribers, just about to tick over 3.6 million subscribers. Well, I think I'll hit 3.6 by next week. So if I'm uncertain about the legitimacy of a breach, I will often just go, okay, give me the last like 30 subscribers for Have I Been Pwned that are in this breach, and I'll ping them and I'll go, look, does this data look like yours? And I did certainly have some positive confirmations there, and I also had a few that were a bit spurious, shall we say, as well. So all of this added up to me flagging it as unverified. So I feel like this story has maybe not run its full course yet, but if there's anything interesting in the future, we might come back and talk about that. Now I'm going to talk about something else, which is the one that got a bit controversial this week, but I'm just looking at the comments here. Tim felt the automation pain today, spent 2 hours flashing a light bulb. Now, when you say flashing a light bulb, anyway, only to realize it was still too new to flash. Still love it though. This is one of the reasons I haven't, like I literally sat there with one of the RGB downlights the other day and I was looking at it going, I wonder if I could flash that. I'll just have a quick Google. And then we start talking about like soldering and which Arduino boards you need. And so I just want to turn on my bloody lights. I really don't want to go down this path. That said, I have had a bit of flakiness with my IoT network and lights recently. And I'm not sure if there's been a few little Wi-Fi dropouts for some of the devices, because some of them are starting to end up some odd places. And if maybe I shouldn't be looking at MQTT to actually be message queuing stuff out. So at least if the thing is not accessible right at the moment when I run the automation, hopefully the message would sit in the queue and deliver like a second later or something. But it's just one of those things where I need to sit down, take the time and figure out like what's working, what's not. For the most part, it's very good, but there's just a couple little idiosyncrasies there. Jason Shears from Toowoomba. G'day, Jason. Someone much, much closer to home. Now, like me, and probably dry, which is good. Tim says, Bunnings are like to Tasmota. So, Tim, I'm interested, if you want to drop a link, what light did you actually get that you're trying to flash? Because I went to Bunnings the other day and I got some Arlec ones that had the traditional sort of screw and I got some that had the pin as well. And they were only about $18, which I thought was a bit of a bargain. And then I paired them with the 2-year app, which seemed to go fine. All right, now let's do the controversial thing, 2FA. Now, this was a story by Joe Cox on the Vice magazine website. And the title here is "A Hacker Got All My Texts for $16. A byline says, "A gaping flaw in SMS lets hackers take over phone numbers in minutes by simply paying a company to reroute text messages." It's a good story. It's really, really interesting because it sort of showed how easy it was for someone to get control of Joe's phone. Let me rephrase it, because I didn't get control of his phone. How easy it was to reroute text messages to him. So if you had TOTPs, for example, sent to you via SMS, this person was able to grab them. Interesting story, shows yet more problems with SMS. And then the Peanut Gallery got involved, as they're prone to do on Twitter. And a lot of the discussion became about how 2FA with SMS is worse than no 2FA, or is worse than password alone. And it just doesn't compute. Like, it doesn't compute to say a password plus an additional form of verification is worse than only a password. It's like one plus something that is a positive number is not less than one, if you know what I mean. Now, I think it's worthwhile qualifying where people are coming from here, because we're sort of conflating issues here. What many people said is that the issue is that you might end up with a situation where you can do account recovery via SMS alone. Now, of course, if you can do anything via SMS alone, it's no longer 2FA. That is 1FA. And it's not the good one either. It's the bad one. Like, the good one is a password that is strong and unique and all the rest of it. The bad one is an SMS which is easily hijacked. Readily hijacked. I think easy is maybe too strong a word here. And as I said to many people in the discussion, so I did this tweet and I said here, I was going to write something longer about it, but I can summarize it. Password only is less than password plus SMS is less than password plus authenticator app is less than password plus U2F. And I stand by that position, and I've written a blog post some time ago about the hierarchy of 2FA, which effectively goes along the same lines I just denoted there. But I don't like the premise where people, and some people are quite noteworthy as well, pop up and they say, look, just don't use SMS 2FA at all. You're better off just using a password alone, because this just simply doesn't make any sense. So there are a couple of issues here. Now, one of them is the one we just raised, which is that if you set up an account and the service, and honestly, that like the responsibility should be on the services not to do this shit because it's ridiculous, but if the service then allows account recovery via SMS alone, that is a very, very bad thing, because that is now one weak factor of authentication used for controlling the entire account. Who cares about having 2FA on the login if you can just go and recover the entire thing with an SMS? It just doesn't make any sense. So there's that. I had other people talking about things like, well, it can be worse because not everyone can get SMSs, or not everyone has devices that can do SMSs, or things which I kind of felt was missing the point. Because the point was, if you have the ability to use 2FA, using SMS makes it worse, is what some people are saying. But if you're saying, well, some people don't have the ability to use it, well, then it's not a problem, is it? Like, you're not going to have a drama with someone hijacking your SMSs if you're not sending SMSs. It did feel a little bit like security absolutism, where people are sort of going, and I quite like this term, people often say, well, look, if you can't do it perfectly, if you can't get it absolutely spot on, then we shouldn't be doing it at all. The reality of it is that SMS for as a 2FA mechanism actually has something very, very strong going for it that authenticator apps and U2F do not have. And it's simply this: my mum and dad can use it. And that is a very, very strong thing. Now, this is not to be disingenuous to my mum and dad. They're early 70s, and like many people in their early 70s, they have not grown up with technology like we have. And for them, the concept of an authenticator app is a hard thing. If you don't agree with me, I would love you to come and set it up for my mum and dad and support them the next time they migrate one of their mobile devices and they don't manually back up their 2FA and then go through the restoration process. Or the next time they try to log on to a service which requires the U2F token, and that service is saying, hey, please open your authenticator app and pull back the token. And they're like, I got no idea. The thing the SMS has going for it is that pretty much everybody knows how to use it. I was going to say everybody, but I'm sure there are edge cases where some people don't want to use SMS. I'm struggling to think of people who have online accounts and know how to use passwords and know how to log on to an online account, but don't know how to receive an SMS. Because we're in an era where everybody, just about everybody, has a mobile device can receive an SMS. So the thing it has going for it is that everyone knows how to use it. Rounds to everyone. So if my mum and dad are trying to log in somewhere and it says, all right, you got your username, you got your password right, we have sent you an SMS with a code, please enter the code, they're like, well, I know how to do this. I get SMSs all the time. I send them all the time. We are adept at SMSs, so therefore we can use this technology. And the accessibility of it is a massive, massive, massive thing. It's the same reason we still have passwords, even though we have much technically better security controls. Passwords, for all their flaws, are something that everybody knows how to use. It's the same reason we still have knowledge-based authentication. It's ridiculous asking someone what their date of birth is or their mother's maiden name is and then assuming that that is somehow going to prove that they are who they say they are. But everybody knows their date of birth and everybody knows their, rounds to everybody, everybody knows their mother's maiden name. So you see where I'm going with this, that the reason this stuff sticks is because of the usability. And no matter how right you think you are, if you're saying that all of this is stupid and it just shouldn't exist at all, you can't deny the fact that it is massively prevalent and there is a reason. This didn't happen by accident. Okay, so am I done on my high horse there? Was there something else related to SMS? Here's the other thing. I then had a bunch of people saying, well, look, it's basically useless because it's so easy to circumvent. You know, look how easy they got into Joe's account. You've got to think about the threat. Because in the situation of Joe, now Joe, incidentally, in this story he wrote, did actually authorize someone to do this. So he was targeted, very, very specifically targeted. And if you are very specifically targeted and you're using SMS, and I will suggest that it is going to be different in the US to Australia to the UK to the Norway to wherever you might be in the world, because it does come down to the way telcos handle numbers and the ability people have to access those numbers. And I'll give you an Australian example in a moment. When you're targeted in that fashion, there are a whole bunch of risks associated to SMS. But if we're looking at some of the other threats that we're worried about, such as credential stuffing, suddenly SMS is actually really good, and $16 is a massive barrier to entry. There are credential stuffing lists that have billions, like with a B for Bravo, billions of entries in them, and people are taking these lists with billions of entries and they're throwing them against services and they're trying to log on with them. Now imagine with this list of billions, you're going to get a substantial number of them on any given service where the username and the password work. But imagine the username and the password work and then it says, now you need to enter the code that we have just SMS'd to you. Suddenly, this changes things dramatically because not only do you have to then put in the legwork to actually take over the text message or intercept the text message or redirect it, however we want to refer to it, not only do you need to do that, you need to come up with $16 and you need to come up with it over and over and over and over again. And if you can't do that or you won't do that or it just doesn't have a good ROI, then those accounts remain protected. So you're seeing it in a mass non-targeted scenario like that. And we're talking about something that is massively prevalent now. Credential stuffing has just gone crazy the last few years. This mechanism of 2FA is extremely effective. And then it's just not very effective if you're targeted and you're in a part of the world where people can take over numbers too easily. Now, I had a discussion with a telco a while ago, and it boiled down to this because I was saying, look, why don't you make it harder for people to say port the number to another provider? And the telco said, because anti-competitiveness. Because we need to have an open marketplace where people can port their number, which they've had for could be ages, they need to be able to port their number from one telco to another. And if we make it too hard for them to do that, for example, forcing them to actually turn up at the telco and show physical ID, then we are breaching the not anti-monopolistic rules, anti-competitive rules. We're basically taking away we're increasing the friction people have to choose their own provider. Now, of course, the irony there is that that is also increasing the friction for attackers to go and hijack your SIM card. But you see the paradox there. And I think the problem we keep coming back to is like an impedance mismatch between the expectation of telcos about how secure an SMS is, because I don't think that they think they are particularly secure, versus the expectation of people who are using them for a second factor of authentication. Right. Glad I got that off my chest. Let me look at the comments here. Tim says, Bunnings, where are they? These same ones you mentioned, but here in NZ, made the mistake of connecting it via the Grid Connect app, which may have flashed the firmware to the latest. Oh, that's interesting. Well, fortunately, because they are such cheap lights, you can just go get another one and give it a go, or just return it to Bunnings. Just walk in there and slip it into another box, and then I don't know if that you're not meant to do that, or I've never done that. Anyway, point is, try the 2-year one, because definitely when I plugged them to 2-year, there were no firmware updates or anything like that, and they have integrated quite well, and I am using the 2-year integration Home Assistant to control them. Strauss says, take a drink every time Troy says SMS. Oh, geez. That was before I said SMS all those times. Ali says, have there been any news on Arvind Cloud, biggest Iranian IS breach? I don't do a lot of Iranian news. In fairness, if there was something significant, I'd cover it. But you don't often see Iran feature in the CyberSec news. Not in that way, anyway, not as a victim of a data breach. 30,000 VMs were affected. Well, no, I have not heard anything more about that. Tim says, how's the book going, Troy? and other soon-to-be-announced spin-off part of Have I Been Pwned Passwords? How much can I say? The book is progressing. For those of you just hearing about the book, so this is a book I'm writing with someone that many of you know, and not the obvious people. That is a collection of different blog posts over the years, and there's a lot more insight into what happened behind the scenes that prompted it and things that happened afterwards, and there's a lot of other stories in there. It's significant. I'll tell you how many hundreds of pages it is a little bit later on. It's taking a lot of time, and I've just had a bunch of other stuff that has really, really consumed a lot of time and, if I'm honest, emotional effort. And there might be things that I'll talk about later on. And then I get things like this stupid audio that are just blown hours today. So one of my next tasks is to find the time to sit down and write a blog that explains who's behind it, what we're doing, and also to get ideas from people about what they'd like to read in the book. So I hope maybe I can even do that within the next week and get that blog post out. And the second part of your question was the other bits of Have I Been Pwned and Pwned Passwords. So there's a couple of things coming very, very soon that I've literally drafted off and sent off to people for review this week. So I am happy with the progress I have made. And the stuff that we're going to be able to announce when I can talk about it, I think is really, really cool. And I'm super, super happy. And everyone will get access to it for free. Let's just say that. And it's definitely just a 100% community first thing. Yeah, that's all I'm saying for now. You'll read about it. I think this will be a next month thing. And I think it will hopefully be a maybe 2 to 3 week time frame sort of thing. Tequila says, my 80-year-old uncle had an issue with the online banking and they pulled SMS 2FA support and required him to have an authenticator app on his phone instead. He doesn't have a smart mobile phone. And I think this is sort of where people were going a little bit when they were arguing that there is a somewhat degree question of privilege, and I'm not even sure if privilege is the right word here, but perhaps accessibility to technology in terms of SMS. But I would argue that if you have any 2FA whatsoever, then the lowest barrier to entry, particularly for less technical people, is going to be SMS. And then after that, it's going to be probably U2F after that, because I would argue it's easier for people to stick a USB stick in the PC than it is to pull up your authenticator app and get the code and I don't know, but SMS is still going to be the easiest thing by far. And, of course, you don't need to have a smartphone for that. There are people out there who do not have smartphones, and particularly in some parts of the world as well. I remember one of the things that was really I found really interesting about India a few years ago, and unfortunately I've never gotten to go to India, but just some of the projects I did there, was that there was massive adoption rates of SMS but very low adoption rates of smart devices compared to the rest of the world. So there are plenty of parts of the world, and I'm sure it's the same in many other emerging markets too, where they would have access to things like SMS, but not access to things like a modern-day smartphone. Stefan says, always create UUIDs for the answers, mother's maiden name, first job. And this is a great use of a password manager too. Now, I have always thought that it's going to be fun one day when my bank asks me what's my mother's maiden name or something. And I'm like, okay, you ready for this? Because I've got a lot of funny characters in it. But fortunately, I don't think in any of the cases where I've just randomly generated strings I've been asked. But you can randomly generate strings. And incidentally, there are many data breaches in Have I Been Pwned where security questions and answers have been exposed. If you go to Who's Been Pwned, search for security questions, you'll see. So you got to remember that something that you're using for identity verification could actually be leaked in a breach and then exploited other places. Something like date of birth can be a bit hard because depending on the nature of the service, there are legitimate use cases where your date of birth is required, and you can't always lie about that. We can't have everybody born on the 1st of January. But where you're getting questions around mother's maiden name, I hope no one's asking for like favorite color or favorite movie or something transient like that. It's certainly happened in the past. But those ones you can definitely generate random strings for and store them in your favorite password manager, which of course is 1Password, right? All right. Tim says, what are your thoughts on shared accounts for IT operating teams? 2FA needs to be done, but it's only a single device, SMS authenticator. I wonder in a case like that, shared accounts for IT operations teams. So this would be like a service account or something like that. So it's a good question. It's a messy one, isn't it? Any thoughts on multi-forward device, e.g. register once, which then fires MFA to multiple downstream team accounts? That is honestly a good question, and it's not one I've given a lot of thought to, partly because I've managed to extract myself from enterprise for almost 6 years now. I'm about to have my six-year anniversary of freedom. But back then when I was in Pfizer and we had lots of things like service accounts, it'd be, yeah, multiple people would know their credentials for the service account and there wouldn't be a second factor required. But there are also different, very, very different risk profiles and different footprints too. I honestly don't have a good answer off the top of my head, but if you find one, bring it next week because I'd love to hear. Popcorn, finally managed to watch your live stream. Awesome. Cool. Thank you. Someone asking at CNA Breach, huge US insurer specializing in cyber insurance. I can't remember if I've spoken about that one or tweeted about that one or not. And if I was just to quickly spin through my Twitter profile, I have tweeted or retweeted so many breaches like in any week, but it just feels like, especially over the last week. So, all right, Bleeping Computer, engineer reports data leak to Aperta, hears from police. Okay, that was, when was that? That was 23 hours ago. What else here? Thousands of taxpayers' personal details potentially exposed online through council's debt-chasing texts. This was in the register. That was yesterday. What else was in here? There was a Joe Cox one, I think, the day before that. Fastway had a data breach. Fat Face, never heard of Fat Face before. Fat Face had a data breach. I actually did a thread on this because I wasn't real happy with their disclosure notice. And I said, it feels a bit misleading because they say our systems are fully secure. I like the way they say fully. It's not like mostly secure, pretty good, almost fully. I mean, other than the data breach, fully secure. And Fat Face remains a safe place to shop online or in person. And then I was like, yeah, except for the data breach. And then they said the above payment card information cannot be misused for fraudulent transactions. But the problem was they had partial card data there. So I think they had like the last four digits of the card number. And as I've said here, like that is data that is often used for identity verification. Now, there was a really good story from many, many years ago from a guy called Matt Honan, who was a journalist for Wired. And I just remember the title was about his epic hacking. And if you Google Matt Honan epic hacking, part of the attack that ultimately gave the attackers the ability to wipe his phone and a whole bunch of his photos and things like this was that they got partial card data from one location and they used it as identity verification in another location. So I do not like seeing partial card data being trivialized. And as I said here, it feels like a lot of emphasizing their security posture, even in the face of a breach and downplaying the severity of the incident, followed by an acknowledgement that identity theft protection would be a good idea. I'd give it a 5 out of 10 for quality disclosure notice. Now, I do own Is My Data Breach Disclosure Notice Hot or Not.com. You can go and check it. And one day I would love to do just like an assessment of was my data breach disclosure notice any good. Now, the other thing that wasn't actually captured when I screen capped the fat face disclosure notes that someone sent to me is the subject line of the email was strictly private and confidential notice of security. And so it's like, it's a generic notice. In fact, multiple people forwarded it to me and joked about the fact that Fat Face, first of all, I'm just having a bit of trouble getting over the name, but Fat Face had said their disclosure notice is strictly private and confidential. So what? So you hope people don't know about it? Well, good luck with that. It's one sure way of people knowing about it. Anyway, I got onto that thread because there's just a heap of tweets here about various data breaches and things that happened during the week. And I would suggest that not a day goes by, at least on average, not a day goes by where I'm not tweeting about a new data breach story. It's just crazy. Okay, what else is on here? Stratus just put on fingerprint access to a phone, loves it. I've got fingerprint access. I've got an external verified device for my desktop. My laptop's got it built in, and in fact, it's driving me nuts because this Lenovo P1 fingerprint reader started playing up a few weeks ago and has become really unreliable, and it's killing me to have to type a password into that. So yeah, I absolutely like biometrics. I like biometrics on the iPhone, iPad, all that sort of stuff as well. I think it's a lovely way of authenticating. Frederick, I'd actually buy the book and put it on my shelf. I don't like to read on PC. So the discussion that we've been having is that it will certainly be digital. It'll probably be digital initially, but I would like to see something physical in print as well. And even when I look behind me, there's a lot of books that like literally sit on the shelf. And in all honesty, I don't pick up a lot of them and read them anymore, but everything there I've either read or partially read. And it is something nice to like hold a book in your hand. And I've never done a book before. And a lot of people, I remember years ago, a lot of people being publishers would say, oh, you should read a book. You know, people will take you seriously then. And I eventually got to the point where it's like, look, I think we have crossed that bridge. You know, like I don't feel the need to write a book so that people are like, oh, he's arrived. I want to do it because I want to do it for me. And it's like, have I been pwned? It's like the blogs. I want to do this stuff because I want to do it, not because someone else wants me to do it or because it's a money stream or something like that. I doubt it will make much money. I just want to do it. This one here, Popcorn. I personally asked several NYPD officers to use Have I Been Pwned. They're using it and super happy with it. So fun story about NYPD. So I did a they didn't want me talking too much about it at the time, but I think it's okay now. I did a talk for the NYPD Cybersecurity and Counterterrorism Conference in New York a few years ago. And it was a really fascinating event to go to because it was full of three-letter acronym departments from around the world, including like Aussie Federal Police and things like this. And there were about 500 people there when I did this keynote. And it was right next to the World Trade Center Ground Zero, which that was my first ever trip to New York. So I had never seen World Trade Centers before or after. I went and did the tour and everything, and then went and did the keynote at the event. And it was to have like a cybersecurity and counterterrorism conference all bundled in together right next to what is arguably the world's most notable terrorism location was really, really fascinating. And I just remember like I went up on stage and I think it was about a half-hour keynote, and there's just like a room full of like FBI and, you know, Aussie Federal Police, and like wherever you're from, there was probably one of your people there. And I was like, shit, I'm going to go and talk about a lot of stolen data in front of these guys. I really hope I get out. But what was the coolest thing is afterwards, a bunch of people from those various departments came out and said, hey, you know, this tool is really, really awesome. We use it all the time. And I was like, man, that's cool. Like, what do you use it for? And very often they said they use it for education. So they will use it internally as part of education programs. And in fact, I was speaking to a journalist today from the Australian Financial Review who had been having a discussion with one of our ministers of parliament. And the MP had said, yeah, look, they use it as well. And again, for education purposes. And that stuff is just super, super cool. So thank you for sharing that, Popcorn. It's it is really good to hear because it's particularly these days, it's like I sit here in this bubble and build and maintain everything. And I think some people like it, which is nice, but it is always nice hearing firsthand stories like that as well. What else we got in here? David, doesn't your laptop support Windows Hello face lock on? No, it doesn't, because for Windows Hello, you need not just a camera, but you need, I believe the requirement is also for an IR sensor as well. Now, I did have a Logitech Brio before I started using this camera here that had Windows Hello support, and it would do the face thing. I do find the fingerprint reader a little more reliable, if I'm honest. But I definitely don't have Windows Hello support in the camera of the laptop. And normally the fingerprint works fine. I'm not sure if there's like a driver update that screwed it up or if it's just dirty or something like that. I'm putting it in the same bucket as the Apollo Twin DAC, which is like make time to do something that's not very fun but needs to be done. What types of books are on the shelf, business or pleasure reading? There's a bit of a mix, if I'm honest. There's everything from like just looking through it. Zero Day, Mark Vucinovic's novel, which is good fun. There's a lot of stuff that I had even when I was in university that I've just kept because increasingly it's for the memories, like HTML for Dummies, you know, How I Learned to Program for the Web. There's a whole bunch of Unix books and things. Bunch of books have been given. Some of them I've actually read. Some of them I've read part of. There's one here. There's a biography on Johnny Ive. A few things. Where are we? Almost need to do like a special episode just on my bookshelf. There's a few things here that are around presenting. So what's the name of it? So I used to be able to find stuff really easily, but then Charlotte is a very, very organized, systematic person. So she organized all the books by color. So all the red books are together. And the white books are together and the blue books are together and they've got nothing to do with each other, but they do look very neat. As a result, I'm really not sure how to find much stuff here. DOS for Dummies, Spam Nation, that was a good one. Some of Kevin Mitnick's bits and pieces, Art of Intrusion is in there. Microsoft DOS 5, have a look at this. This is a classic. Because I never know when I'm going to need this again, and this is obviously in the blue section of the bookshelf, and one day, I don't know, it might be useful. DOS shell, understanding memory, extended memory, understanding batch programs. This has now just become more of a memory, this kind of memory, than anything else. But if I'm honest, I have a lot of trouble maintaining enough attention to read books, and that frankly is something that I need to work on personally. Okay, what else is in here? There's a question here about which HTML for Dummies. I have HTML 3.2. I don't think it was that advanced. It was certainly wasn't HTML 4. It was earlier than that. This is the second edition, put it this way. So this would be like a 1995, if not earlier, book. Where do you even find the date these days? And the thing that struck me with this, so I've been teaching my son, who's 11, some web development. We do it in bits and spurts. But basically everything in here is still relevant. Except Blink and Marquee. We don't do that shit anymore. But everything else is pretty relevant. The thing that struck me the most is that all the tags are in uppercase, and I'm looking at it going, at what point did uppercase tags just become like a code smell? You know, somehow it feels super, super, super dirty now when I see an uppercase tag. So I'm not quite sure when we transition, but it certainly doesn't feel very good anymore. I can't even see a date on this. But I definitely remember getting right into this in 95, so it is at least that old. Mark says, we use at Southern Cross University, which I assume have been paying. That's great. I've heard lots of stories actually about universities and so on using it too, which is super, super cool. There's some other account stuff there people can argue with each other about. Welcome to the back of Troy's head. It feels a bit like that. How has the 3D printer been going? Any thoughts after a few weeks of usage? So first immediate thought is it is probably the best thing I've ever bought for the kids in terms of an educational tech thing. Now, It's probably also the most expensive educational tech thing I've ever bought for the kids. So this is a Prusa Mark III S Plus, if anyone's interested. So you can go to their website and have a look. I think that fully built, they're just under $1,000 US. And if you get the one that's not built, it was like $150 cheaper. And you build it yourself and you learn a lot, which is what I did. So it's just been fantastic for the kids to learn about things. So keep in mind, my kids are 8 and 11, so they're old enough to be competent with a PC and with software, and also old enough, even for my daughter at 8, to handle a 230-degree hot end. I'm fine with that. If she burns herself, it's a very, very small hot end. So I think it's great for that age, and what we've been doing is a lot of stuff around when you're doing 3D modeling, understanding X, Y, and Z axes, understanding things like setting dimensions when you're creating a cube. So, you know, do we want to make it wider or deeper or higher? And then understanding, so it's almost like a spatial awareness thing. So if you're getting multiple objects together in a 3D space, where do they intersect? I'll give you a good example. So my daughter Elle wanted to make a name tag for a friend of hers, and the friend's name had an I in it. So she wanted to have like a name tag that she could hang on a bag or something. So she creates the friend's name tag with the text tool using Tinkercad, tinkercad.com, fantastic resource. Creates it, and she's looking on the screen, and I'm like, all right, what do you think's going to happen when you print that? And she's looking at it, and she's having to sort of imagine what this digital thing will look like when it's sitting there in front of her. And she's like, well, the dot on the eye won't be attached anymore, will it? So no. All right, cool. So what are we going to do instead? We'll capitalize everything, because if we capitalize it, everything's still attached. And then later on we said, well, you know, we could do another one. In fact, we did one for my son. He's an Ari, so he's got an eye. We created like a flat plate, and then on top of that we extruded the letters, and then he has that on his door. But because all the letters are sitting on a flat plate, there obviously everything stays attached and it stays in place. So that's just been absolutely fantastic to see them having to go through that thought process in the design. But then also I think just the responsibility of unloading the filament, loading it back up, watching the temperature go up, cleaning the metal sheet that it's printed onto, all that sort of stuff has just been absolutely fantastic. And in fact, I had parent-teacher interviews for both of them this week. And on both occasions, I spoke to the teachers about it, and the teachers were really impressed with what they'd been doing. Now, speaking of teachers, a really good mate of mine, a guy who's been a mate since kindergarten, is the one who put me onto the Prusa. I saw it in Adelaide or further down South Australia when I visited him in January on my big road trip. And he is a math teacher. So I was chatting to him the other day about what are the things that he's using to teach his students math. So the example he gave when I was there, and I can't remember exactly because we drank a lot of beer, but it was something along the lines of that the way you calculate the area of a pyramid can be really easily demonstrated when you can deconstruct the pyramid after it's turned into a 3D object with little magnets on the side to join it all together. So he sent me a bunch of things that I want to start printing with the kids, and some of it might even be a little bit advanced, like devices where when they roll, they create a perfect sine wave. I don't think my son, even at 11, has learned about sine waves and things like that yet, but this might be a good intro. I have a draft blog post going, which is all the stuff that I've been doing with the kids. So it's basically, here's my experiences and the things I've found that actually work really well. And I want to do a second blog post, which is, here are the mathematical concepts we're starting to learn. And frankly, even for me, I did pretty well at maths at school, but I've forgotten most of it. I think this will be really cool to go back and visit it and go, here are things you can 3D print to teach kids maths. Because if they get a kick out of printing, and my daughter will, like, she'll like sit there on the chair, like right in front of the printer, and she's just watching it, and she's just watching all the layers go like this. She's fascinated by it. So if that gets her interested in the thing that's being produced, and the thing that's being produced teaches her something that she might not have learned otherwise, then again, money well spent. What else we got on the list here? You're a great father, Troy. Look, I have, some would argue, a privilege in the opportunities that I can give the kids. One of the other things that I was talking to Ari's teacher about this week, in fact, I said to him beforehand, I said, mate, before I go and see your teacher, the Savo, like, what do you want me to tell him? And he said, "Oh, tell him how much I like going and doing the coding talks in London and Oslo the last couple of years." So obviously we haven't been able to travel anywhere the last year, but January last year, he came to Oslo and London with myself and Scott Helm and Charlotte, and he did some talks and some teaching kids to code at the NDC conferences. And the year before, he had also been there and taught them that. And that's something that very, very few kids get an opportunity to access. And I'm really conscious that it is an enormous privilege for them to do that. And I keep trying to ram that into him. It's like, mate, do you know how lucky you are? Like, honestly, you've got such a leg up with this. So I'm conscious that I get to give them that opportunity. But I think things like the printing, yes, like there's a cost barrier to entry. But even if you don't go and buy a printer, you can still go to Tinkercad.com and you can design this stuff. Find a friend with a printer, give it to them. Or you can send stuff away to get printed. Or increasingly schools have printers. Like, there are lots of ways that everybody can get their kids doing this. But yeah, my kids are exceptionally lucky having that access and that opportunity. What else are we going to hear? Beer o'clock. I think you're pretty much right there. I first saw and heard about your works around 10-ish years ago. I was in North Pole. Wow, okay, that's a long way away. Deep inside the Arctic Circle in the Norwegian Peninsula doing my works. It just took 10 years to be live. All right, awesome. Well, that is a very positive note to end on, and I would really like to go to the top of Norway towards North Pole. I want to go to Svalbard one day, and I know there's polar bears, but I reckon I am prepared for wild animals, and it can't be any worse than what I have to deal with here day in and day out. Thank you very much for watching. I'll come back again in a week from now, hopefully with fully working equipment, so less whinging about that, and I'll come back a little bit earlier in the day when it's coffee o'clock instead of beer o'clock, which is what I'm going to right now. See you, folks.